Unaffordable rent or unaffordable mortgage is the choice facing many Australians these days. Cooperative housing, though, may provide a middle way for some. It's a form of renting that provides stability without having to come up with a big deposit. And the rent is set according to your income. But you do have to be very involved in the running of the venture. In a moment, we will hear from a researcher who produced the first comprehensive study into Australia's affordable rental housing cooperatives. But first, let's find out what it's like to live in one. Emma Mitchell is going to be ideal for this. She's a postdoctoral researcher, and she's also lived in a co-op in Enmore in Sydney for 11 years. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Hilary. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Tell us how you came to end up in this form of housing.
Oh, well, I first learnt about co-ops when I was at Sydney Uni, and there's a co-op for students attached to Sydney Uni called Stucco. And so I had friends living in the co-op. And once you're sort of aware of it, you think, oh, that looks good. My sister actually moved into a co-op, and she was there for a while. And then they had a vacancy, a pretty rare vacancy of a two-bedroom townhouse. And so my partner and I applied and were lucky enough to get it.
So how do you, you have to apply. How do you get picked?
So the tenants, the existing tenants in the co-op get together and go through the process of selecting members. So there's eligibility criteria. So they'll, do an assessment based on how many low-income tenants they already have living in the co-op, what kind of skills they need to kind of complement the skills that are already existing in the co-op. And so there's an application process with a form. You talk about your housing need, and then there's an interview process as well. And so you go through that, and then together, I imagine it might be different at different co-ops, but in my co-op, then as all of the tenants get together and vote on who they'd like to be accepted as the new member.
And what was it like moving in, Emma? You'd been in private rental before that. How different was it?
It was amazing, honestly. It's a fairly modest two-bedroom townhouse, but I felt like I was moving into a mansion because it had, a shared garden. Was the first garden I'd had in Sydney. And I honestly felt like a physical weight had lifted off me. The two private rentals I'd been in before, there'd been a lot of back and forth with the agents and landlords to try and get repairs done. And so coming into the co-op knowing that I had some security going forward, I honestly felt physically relieved.
And you do have some responsibilities as part of your tenure there, don't you? You've been on the finance committee, among other things. How much of your time does it take to kind of pull your weight communally?
Yeah, it really fluctuates. So we kind of say to people who are interested in the co-op, be prepared to dedicate 5 hours a week. But often I will not need to give that amount of time every week, but there will be times where things get busier. So, for example, on the finance committee, we do rent reviews every 3 months and 6 months to make sure that people aren't paying kind of more than they need to or less than they need to. And so that takes a bit more time. Or annually we audit the co-op because we're an organisation. And so that involves, that'll be a good chunk of time. It might be that my weekends in July are more taken up with co-op work. So we sort of generally say 5 hours a week, but it really comes in swings and roundabouts, I think.
Is there like physical labour as well? Do you have to, sweep the kitchen from time to time? How does it work with the commonly shared areas?
Yeah, in my co-op, my townhouse I share only with my partner, so it's not share housing, but we do have a common garden, a common garage and driveway. So the way we've managed that is we came up with a monthly roster. And so one tenant is responsible each month for taking out the bins, for mowing the lawns, for sweeping up leaves, that kind of thing.
Interesting. Emma, it's really fascinating learning how it works on the ground in your co-op. And I'll be checking in with you as we speak to a researcher today too about how your experience reflects this. And Emma, just quickly tell us how the rent is set. How do they work out who should be paying what?
Yeah, so the way it works is it's 25% of your income will be the rent amount or market rent, whichever's lower. So it sort of favours the more affordable end of things. The great thing is that if your income fluctuates, your rent can fluctuate as well. And I think that has been, one of the biggest aspects of security for me, as an early career researcher, having contracts and not having contracts, knowing that I'm, still going to be able to cover the rent even if my income drops.
Yeah, the PhD being a notoriously lucrative money spinner. We're speaking with Emma Mitchell, who's a postdoctoral researcher now and has lived in a co-op in Sydney in Enmore for 11 years or so. And we're also joined by Professor Louise Crabtree-Hayes. She's a professorial research fellow at Western Sydney University. Louise, great to have you on the program.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Hilary.
Now, just before we get into this new study that you've done on the value of housing cooperatives in Australia, structurally, how do they tend to work in this country? Who runs them and how do the nuts and bolts work?
Sure. So the co-ops that we looked at are part of the community housing sector. So in that sector, the stock is either owned by the government or by a community housing provider, which is a registered non-profit in a regulated sector. And then the co-op manages the property, and the co-op's made up of the tenant members. So people like Emma, who live in the co-ops and take part in its daily management.
And so you're looking at the value of this model. Obviously, it can be incredibly liberating to someone on a low or a fluctuating income. But what about more broadly in the situation of housing crisis that we're seeing in this country? How do you measure the value of that model?
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting question. And we looked at it in terms of how it compares to other forms of community housing in terms of the cost of running the sector, but also the values that are generated, like that sense of stability and community, the skills development, the educational and employment outcomes that can come from it, and particularly that sense of voice, agency and empowerment that co-op members experience, which really is unique to the model.
That's interesting. We'll get to the skills development in a moment, but I'm interested in how much it costs to run a housing co-op compared to other parts of the sector. What did you find?
We found that they're pretty much on par, but it does vary, and that's because of the diversity in the sector. So there are co-ops that do a lot of their management and there are co-ops that do less. So the community housing provider that they're in partnership with may do more. And obviously in those instances, it costs less because the co-op's doing more of its own labour. But we found on average they are about on par with other forms of community housing. But the more that co-op members participate, the lower the cost to the community housing provider.
And what was the length of tenancy compared to other forms of rental?
Oh, it was really quite striking. We found that over half of the respondents in the survey that we did had been in the sector, in the co-op sector at large, for more than 10 years, and just under half had been in the home they're in now for more than 10 years. So again, like Emma. So that's really quite striking in as a comparison to the sort of turmoil that we hear about in the private rental sector.
We're speaking with Professor Louise Crabtree-Hayes, and I don't think turmoil is an overreach there. There's a lot of people who've had a terrible time in the private rental sector. Louise is a professorial research fellow at Western Sydney University who's been looking into the effects of this model of social housing, I guess, a different kind of renting. You talked earlier, Louise, about that sense of belonging. Tell us a bit more about what effect it has, this longer term stability for people and that sense of being part of a community. How powerful is that?
It was really striking. We've got a report that's now available online and people can download, and we made a point of really having a lot of quotes in there because the strength of what people were saying in terms of that impact was really extraordinary. People talking about it as life-changing, and being able to keep their kids in the same school, their kids having a sense of home and being able to put down long-term relationships and friendships with people in the neighbourhood, really profound and literally life-changing impact in terms of just knowing that people are home and people talking about that sense of home and that sense of ownership without technically owning it in the way that we normally understand it. It was absolutely striking. It was one of the most standout features in the data that we looked at.
Emma, would you care to add to that? I mean, you've lived in different kinds of rentals. How much different is it to live in a co-op in terms of the relationships that you form with the community there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the word life-changing, it's a big one, but I don't think it's an overstatement, actually. I think it really does change your outlook on your future. In terms of the social relationships that are possible, I think because you are managing the co-op with other tenants, you have a lot more opportunity for interaction. So, we'll have monthly committee meetings. So I'm on the finance committee. We meet monthly, but also all of the tenants in the co-op meet monthly for general meetings to discuss things. And so we know each other. And then I think that sort of carries over into just how we interact, every day as neighbours then. There's a sense that we have each other's back. We're not a super, communal co-op. We don't, sometimes people hear the word co-op and think we're sort of, all in each other's space, in each other's business. We don't spend a lot of time sort of, all hanging out together or, doing group activities, but we do, share in caring for our common spaces, checking in on each other. If someone's sick and needs a COVID test but they can't make it out, they'll put it on our WhatsApp group. Does anyone have any spares? And if anyone's going to the chemist, they'll offer to collect it. So that kind of thing, I think I've never experienced in any of the private rentals that I've been in.
One tech says, I've seen models work well in Quebec in Canada, but I don't think Australians are practiced in sharing and cooperating with responsibility. It says, we're a country of individuals who don't like to be told what to do. Australians also like to move around more than some nationalities, and this makes co-op management difficult. I think it's a fantastic idea for a small percentage of housing models. And this one's key, I think. Kelly says, what happens if there's conflict in the cooperative? Emma, how does it work at yours? Are there procedures and policies that you need to follow if someone disagrees?
Yeah, there are. So we have policies and procedures that are modelled off common equities policies and procedures. So they're the kind of umbrella organisation that oversees us as a co-op, and also modelled off fair trading policies. So we have grievances and complaints procedures. I think most of the time conflict is dealt with kind of more informally, but it is good to know, and it has been useful to know that there are steps we can follow to try and be as consistent as possible in the way that we're dealing with conflicts when they do come up.
Louise Crabtree-Hayes, we should mention too that this study that you did was partially funded by an Australian Research Council grant and partially funded from within the co-op housing sector. Tell us how you ensure that you're not just hearing the positive spin about co-op life, that you're getting objective and unbiased findings.
Sure. Yeah, we built the project very specifically with that in mind. We had a steering committee that was made up of the project partners who are the community housing providers, and one of those is itself a co-op. So we have got co-ops that are their own community housing providers as well. But we also then had co-op tenant members from the co-ops that are in partnership with the CHPs, and they were all on the steering committee. And initially we were holding separate meetings so that each could talk freely without the other there, in order to design the project the right way and capture the questions the right way. When we then did the data collection, the partners did not have access to that data, so everything was completely anonymized. And when we were talking with the co-ops and talking with tenant members, there was no ability to see who was saying what about which co-op or which co-op was saying particular thing. So we built it very carefully, and that had to go through the ethics committee at Western Sydney Uni, but also at Swinburne and at Newcastle, where we had researchers based as well. Mm. So it was very much built with the sensitivity to make sure that co-op tenant members felt and knew that they could speak absolutely freely without any chance of being recognised or any repercussion to themselves in terms of their housing situation or the relationship with the Peak. So we took that very seriously and designed it up accordingly.
Well, we've been hearing a lot of the positives from yourself and Emma. What were some of the negatives that tenants told you about living in a co-op?
Yeah, the biggest one was how to make sure that participation is equitable. And we used the language of equitable rather than equal because we heard a lot about the need for it to change as people's life circumstances change and for there to be provisions for people to take leave if they had to, but also the need for provisions for the co-op to manage a situation if someone persistently can't or won't take part in the co-op. So it was really how to ensure that the co-op remains functional without anyone feeling like they might lose their housing or sort of be at risk of that sort of situation. There are also some issues around the ageing of the housing stock, which is a universal issue in community and public housing, and also the ageing of the sector. So some of these co-ops have been running for 40 years, and people are starting to think, well, gee, can I keep doing this? And how can the provider step in and say, well, look, we'll do more of this. You can have a bit of a rest. And that's something that the sector's taking very seriously in terms of how it helps people to age in place, particularly in a situation where people have been in their home for 40 years and got those extraordinary connections to their community and to place. So how do you help people keep that while taking away some of the work that might be becoming unmanageable for them? So we've got a chapter and recommendations around how the sector can be supported into the future.
I'll get to that in a moment because, I'd love to hear more about that. Just quickly, we did mention that there were skill building benefits and we should just briefly touch on that because you found in your report, didn't you, that it's not just that, people get to feel part of the co-op, but they're actually building skills that can help them with their educational and employment outcomes.
Yeah, that's right. And we found a direct correlation between participation and skills development. And particularly where people hold formal roles, such as being the chair or the treasurer or being on a particular committee, and that directly transferring through into improved educational and employment outcomes. And we saw it in the statistical analysis that we did, but we also heard it in the interviews that we did where people were saying, and in the survey responses as well, where people were saying, I have learned skills through being part of my co-op and these have directly translated through into my ability to study or I've taken it into the workplace. So it really came through quite strongly as a direct connection that we saw.
Louise, what do you need for a co-op to run well? Is it about the kind of internal dynamics or external support or a bit of both?
It's definitely a bit of both. And so we generated a practice framework based on the data. And it shows the range of inputs that go into it, including the time of the community housing provider, the time of the co-op members, but also things like training and effective onboarding. So Emma was talking about the interview process. There's also training and onboarding as you join, so you know what your responsibilities are and your obligations. We also found a really clear connection between how actively people wanted to join a co-op. So if people said, I wanted to join a co-op more than other forms of community housing, we saw those people showing stronger outcomes than people who were saying, well, I wasn't really fussed, I just needed the housing. So there is this what we call cooperativism, so people's desire to be in a co-op and then learning about it and then taking part as very much a key driver in that. as well as things like a supportive policy environment, the support of their community housing provider, and those sort of external factors.
Well, on that supportive policy environment, we've got several texts going, how can we get more of these? Do you feel, Louise, that there's an appetite to grow this sector, that the government might see it as a useful thing?
I think yes is the short answer. There's definitely growing interest, and that's part of what drove the project, was to be able to show, well, if there is interest, this is what we know about the model, and this is what we know that it can deliver. And so it's really as part of a broader need to grow all forms of social housing, there's definitely a need there to grow cooperatives as part of that, because people are actively seeking them out. And as we've seen, the benefits of them are extraordinary.
Emma Mitchell, you've been in your place for about 11 years. Do you see it as your long-term home at this point?
Yeah, I hope so. I don't think that I will ever be able to own my own home. And also, I don't know that I necessarily would want to. I mentioned that I got into the co-op, or found the co-op, because my sister was there. And so we're actually in the unique position of being able to look after her children together, because we live across the garden from one another. So, you know, it allows me to be super involved in her kids' lives in a way that if we were both looking for rentals and, you know, just dependent on wherever they become available and wherever we can afford them, we wouldn't have that opportunity. So, it's something that I would hold on tightly to and want to keep.
Yep, that sounds like a sentiment shared by a lot of tenant members of housing co-ops. Emma, thanks so much for joining us today and telling us your experience.
Thank you.
Emma Mitchell lives in a co-op in Enmore. She's a postdoctoral researcher in sociology. Louise, thanks so much for sharing the results of your research with us.
Oh, that's an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you here. Professor Louise Crabtree-Hayes, Professorial Research Fellow at Western Sydney University. And that report that they've just released on co-op housing is online, as she said. You can look up the Western Sydney Uni website for details on that.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.